Vikatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Vikatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. You know, if you've spent even 5 minutes online in the last few years, you'll know that free speech is, well, it's this incredibly fundamental value.
But also a complete mess.
Exactly. It's a total mess. Everyone agrees they want it, but nobody, and I mean nobody, seems to agree on where it stops.
That really is the perfect summary. And today, we're trying to move past the shouting matches, you know, the viral tweets, and take a serious look at the philosophical core of this whole debate.
And to do that, we're being guided by Nigel Warburton's framework from his book, Free Speech, a very short introduction.
Our mission for this deep dive, really, is to give you a kind of conceptual toolkit.
Right. Warburton forces you out of that comfortable free speech is absolute position and throws you right into the messy, complex gray areas.
He does. And the central question he tackles is the one we all desperately need an answer to right now, which is, what are the justifiable limits to freedom of expression?
And that question has never felt more urgent. I mean, just think about the speed and the global reach of digital platforms.
It's instant. Speech is instant. It's often anonymous. And it can scale up harassment or misinformation faster than any institution can possibly react.
So all these old philosophical arguments about harm and offense and censorship, they're changing.
They're fundamentally shifting because the medium has just changed everything. And Warburton, he gives us the map we need to navigate this new landscape.
Okay, so let's talk about our guide then. Who is Nigel Warburton and why is he the right person to lead us through what is, let's be honest, a political minefield?
Well, Warburton is a really renowned British philosopher and academic, but he's famous precisely because he's so committed to making these ideas accessible.
He's the co-creator of Philosophy Bites, right? The podcast.
That's the one. He's hosted it, interviewed hundreds of leading thinkers, and he's just brilliant at distilling, you know, decades of complex ideas into these digestible conversations.
And that background is so key here because it really shapes his perspective.
It does. He doesn't come at free speech like a legal scholar trying to change policy or as a political commentator trying to score points.
He comes at it as a pure philosopher.
Exactly. His goal isn't advocacy, it's clarification, it's analysis. He wants to help you think better about the subject.
So he's clarifying arguments, exposing the hidden assumptions we all bring to these debates.
And, most importantly, testing those high-minded principles against some truly difficult real-world examples that really challenge our assumptions.
He's the perfect person to bridge that gap between, you know, academic rigor and public understanding.
So let's pivot to his central premise, because it's actually quite provocative.
Yeah.
Warburton argues that free speech is not a simple, absolute, or self-evident good.
And that's such an important place to start. Because if we treat free speech as an absolute, we inevitably risk violating other key societal values.
Like safety or privacy or protecting vulnerable groups. It's a balancing act.
So if it's about balancing values, what's the core analytical tool he gives us to, you know, to do that balancing?
The tool is historical. It comes from one of the most important texts in this whole debate, John Stuart Mill's On Liberty. Warburton introduces us to Mill's harm principle.
Okay, so for anyone who might have forgotten the textbook definition, what exactly does the harm principle state?
It states that power should only be rightfully exercised over a member of a civilized community against their will to, and this is the key phrase, prevent harm to others.
That short, simple statement becomes the whole starting point.
It's the foundation for everything. Speech can be restricted only if it causes demonstrable harm, not simply because people find it offensive or disagree with it.
So the book's scope, then, is really about testing the limits of that principle in our modern world. He's looking at the challenging borderlands where the right to speak
collides with the need to prevent suffering or injustice.
Right. Things like defamation, hate speech,
blasphemy, and the profoundly difficult question of how this entire framework even holds up when you apply it to the global kind of chaotic world of the modern internet.
So the real challenge the book poses is, when does speech cross that line from being just an unpopular opinion to becoming an actual measurable harm?
To understand where we are now, Warburton takes us back, way back to the foundations. Historically, this debate isn't new at all. He starts with the archetypal example.
The trial and execution of Socrates.
Exactly. That case from 399 BCE is the ultimate warning sign. It's the state punishing a citizen not for, you know, breaking a law about physical harm,
but purely for the act of questioning things. For questioning established sacred beliefs and corrupt institutions, it just sets the stakes immediately.
And then we fast forward dramatically to the 17th century. And the debate shifts thanks to thinkers like John Milton.
This is where we get the marketplace of ideas metaphor, right?
Yes, from Milton's Areopagitica. It's this foundational belief in classical liberalism. The idea is simple. If all ideas are allowed to compete freely in the public square, the truth will eventually win out over falsehood.
So you don't need a state censor.
Because the process of rational debate is self-correcting. Or so the theory goes.
And this brings us right back to Mill, who built his defense of free speech not on some intrinsic natural right,
but on the massive utilitarian value it offers society. It's not about the speaker's right to just say whatever they want. It's about the listener's benefit from hearing everything.
And Warburton breaks down Mill's case into three key justifications. The first is the argument from fallibility.
It's profoundly simple. If you censor an opinion, you might be censoring the truth because, as humans, we are fallible. Mm-hmm. We might think we have the right answer, but we could be wrong.
I think most of us stop there. But the next two arguments are maybe even more powerful for building a resilient society.
I agree. The second is the grain of truth argument. Even if an opinion is mostly false, it might contain a little particle of truth that we need.
A partial insight that helps us build a more complete understanding.
Exactly. Censorship deprives us of that. And finally, there's the third one, the dead dogma argument. If a true opinion is never vigorously contested, it stops being a deeply understood conviction.
It just becomes a mere prejudice.
Logan.
That hits hard today. You think about something like the consensus on democracy. If we stop challenging those ideas, even just for practice, we forget the rational arguments behind them.
And we become totally unprepared when a serious challenge finally comes along.
And throughout all this, Warburton keeps coming back to Mill's crucial distinction. Restriction is justified for harm, but not for mere offense.
A tolerant, pluralistic society requires some emotional resilience. You have to tolerate things that offend you personally.
But this is where the framework just slams into modern complexity. Warburton moves right into case studies, like the difficult, highly charged issue of pornography.
Yes, because once you move beyond direct physical injury, defining harm becomes incredibly complex, especially when you're talking about gender or race.
He looks at the radical feminist critique from thinkers like Catherine MacKinnon and Andrea Dworkin, who argue that pornography isn't just passive speech.
They say it's an act of discrimination and oppression.
So their argument is fundamentally redefining the scope of the harm principle. They're not saying the material is just offensive.
No, they're arguing that it causes systemic harm by objectifying women and contributing to a culture of discrimination and violence.
And that is the philosophical tightrope. It's a claim of profound societal and psychological harm, which is so far removed from mere offense.
It forces us to ask, if speech leads to systemic exclusion or marginalization, can that be proven to qualify under Mill's harm principle? And that proof is incredibly hard to gather.
Which is why other philosophers, like Joel Feinberg, tried to supplement Mill with the offense principle.
Right. This idea that some speech can be so profoundly offensive, so universally loathed, that it's basically a public nuisance and can be restricted.
Like deliberate desecration or maybe online, things like severe targeted harassment.
But Warburton is quick to point out the danger there. If you rely too much on the offense standard, you risk what's called the heckler's veto.
Which is?
You're allowing the most sensitive or maybe the most aggressive group in society to dictate what everyone else can say. The tension is real.
And this leads us straight into the 21st century, where the whole idea of censorship has just broadened enormously. It's not just the government banning a book anymore.
That's right. Warburton shows us the difference between that kind of overt state prohibition and the more insidious chilling effect.
That's where people self-censor.
Exactly. They shut down their own expression, not because they broke a law, but out of fear of social ostracism, losing their job, or just being perpetually harassed online.
And that stifles the marketplace of ideas just as effectively as any government could.
But the most disruptive shift, and what Mill could never have imagined, is the rise of corporate censorship. We have to acknowledge that private companies, Meta, Google, X, wield immense power.
Often opaque power.
Immense opaque control over global discourse. They are de facto censors. They enforce these vague terms of service, making unilateral decisions that affect billions, all without the democratic oversight that applies to governments.
The battleground for free speech has fundamentally shifted.
And the technology itself makes it worse. The global reach creates jurisdictional nightmares. Anonymity allows for trolling and harassment without consequences. But the really critical part is the algorithmic gatekeepers.
Absolutely. The algorithms are optimized for engagement and virality, not for truth.
They curate our feeds, creating those infamous filter bubbles.
What?
They amplify extreme, often false, content because it drives clicks.
This doesn't just challenge the marketplace of ideas. It undermines it. It rigs the system. Truth doesn't necessarily rise to the top anymore.
Spectacle does.
So this analysis leaves us with a kind of philosophical toolkit. Let's try to distill this into the key themes that you should really take away. The first, and most central, has to be that distinction.
The crucial distinction between harm and offense.
Yes. A resilient society has to accept that being offended is just part of public life. You have to cultivate a thick skin.
And the line has to be drawn rigorously, restricting speech only where offense becomes genuine, measurable, and severe harm, like systemic harassment that pushes people out of public life.
Theme two is the centrality and ambiguity of the harm principle.
Mill's principle is the best starting point we have, but harm is just extremely slippery. All the difficult, interesting problems today lie in defining non-physical long-term harm.
Which brings us to theme three. Censorship is not just a government activity anymore.
We have to expand our vigilance. We have to look at the immense power of tech corporations, of social conformity and self-censorship. Together, they stifle open inquiry maybe even more effectively than the state does today.
And finally, a really tough pill to swallow. The marketplace of ideas is an ideal, not a reality.
We honor Milton's vision, but the existence of power imbalances, massive misinformation campaigns, and algorithmic amplification means we can't be so optimistic. We can't assume truth will always win on its own merit.
The system is flawed. It requires constant maintenance.
And these themes are often just distilled so brilliantly in the text itself. Let's touch on a few key ideas that really capture the essence of his analysis.
I love his articulation of Mill's justification. It totally flips the script on how we usually talk about rights. The idea that the most compelling reason to protect free speech is not for the benefit of the speaker,
but for the rest of us.
Yeah. We, the listeners, benefit from hearing all ideas, even the ones we refute.
It just reinforces that utilitarian foundation perfectly.
Yeah.
And then there's the core philosophical challenge, all in a single sentence. In any debate about censorship, the most difficult task is to draw a principled and consistent line between what constitutes genuine harm and what is merely a matter of profound offense.
That one sentence just summarizes the entire intellectual difficulty of the subject.
It really does. And then there's the quote that anchors us right here in the present. In the digital age, the most powerful arbiters of what can and cannot be said are no longer governments alone.
Private corporations like Google, Meta, and Twitter act as a global, private system of censorship.
That quote should be a real wake-up call for anyone who thinks the free speech debate ended with the Bill of Rights.
So how can we use this toolkit in our daily lives? I think we can start with improved media literacy and personal resilience.
How so?
Well, when you see controversial content online, instead of reacting immediately, use the million framework. Just pause and ask yourself, is this genuinely harmful or am I just offended?
That analytical pause is so critical. It fosters a more resilient, thoughtful mindset instead of a reactive one.
We can also become a more informed citizenry. When you see new laws being proposed, like online safety bills, we need to ask sophisticated questions.
Like, is this law narrowly tailored to prevent specific proven harms? Or is it so broad that it's going to create a chilling effect on legitimate expression?
And finally, it demands more responsible online behavior from us. We have to recognize the difference between legitimate, even harsh, criticism.
And targeted harassment that's just aimed at silencing or damaging an individual. We all contribute to the health or the toxicity of the online speech environment.
My final reflection, I think, is that protecting free speech requires so much more than just chanting a slogan. It requires rigorous philosophical thinking.
Yeah.
Warburton shows us that the true test of a free society is its commitment to protecting the speech we find the most hateful or offensive, provided that speech falls short of causing demonstrable structural harm.
And for me, my main takeaway is the ongoing nature of this challenge. The debate is never settled. We've gained a rigorous method from Warburton, not a fixed set of answers.
That's a great way to put it.
We have to be constantly ready to reevaluate these principles.
Yeah.
Because every new technology, AI, VR, whatever comes next, is going to bring fundamentally new challenges that Mill could never, ever have imagined.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.